Good morning and welcome to another episode of the Army's AI Integration Center podcast. I'm Lieutenant Colonel David Paddock and I'm your host for the episode today. I'm joined today by Chief James Yantis from the AI Center here. Chief, it's great to have you here today. Before we get started, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to be here, your background.
Pleasure to be here. Currently coming up on my 20-year mark in the Army. So primarily an intel officer over the career. And then as I came here, I started as a data analyst when I did my master's in 2018 and finished up in 2021, and then did a pivot in 23 into the AI space. And then since coming to the center, ran our soft and cyber portfolio for a while, been a program manager for the multimodal data fusion, and then now lead our PAI research.
So you've got to be pretty involved over several years of being here with the center and either being directly involved with AI or being in some adjacent fields. What are some of the big changes that you've seen that you think are informing where the Army is going to go with this?
So I think some of the biggest changes that have coming out is the realization that we're never going to have enough soldiers to do all the tasks that we needed to do. And the work increases and the demands increase, but the people are not keeping pace with the demands for their velocity of data that's coming at us. And also just the different versions and the different quality of it. So we have to find ways to modernize and bring new technology into the fight.
And coming from the intelligence field, you've got to be very intimately involved with that, both in contingency operations, counterinsurgency, and now in large-scale combat operations. And you bring up an interesting point that we don't have the manpower to do it. Is AI going to help ease that deficiency, or is this something that we should expect that as we get more AI, we're going to have more intelligence and we're still going to have the same shortfalls, we're just going to have them in different places?
I see it as like the whole computer human teaming on this. As we look at the types of data that comes in, we can be able to offload some of the routine repetitive tasks that we know what right looks like, so we can check it and then we can focus more on some of the harder use cases. As we look at adaptation, AI works really well when you have some good defined rules, but as soon as you start bolting on new capabilities or camouflage or other things on there to obscure the computer vision models, it starts to go haywire. So I think that when it comes to a definitive look, we're going to need a human in the role to look at that and ensure that's the most accurate information that we can give commanders versus just offloading onto a machine and hoping that it performs as designed.
And I think it calls back to a lot of things that we've talked about before, both with that human-machine pairing and having that AI/ML and an analyst team that's doing combined work, as well as maintaining that human in the loop aspect, which has been really critical and something that I think is deliberate about the way that the U.S. military has approached artificial intelligence. It almost sounds like what you're saying is that we're always going to maintain that same demand level for qualified, skilled analysts in whatever field they may be, and they're going to be able to spend more of their time doing those high cognitive load tasks and spend less of their time doing the routine work that's more directly offloadable into AIs. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. So as we look at interpreting some of these unstructured data sets or like images, whatever that comes in, that's one part of the PED process. Now, as you look at the follow-on piece of how do I write the report? How do I triage it? How do I get into a database so way other analysts can use it? I think that's where we're going to see a lot of the speed up and a lot of the AI augmentation, because I can process an image pretty quick, but when it comes time to type it up, my supervisor review it, then publish it, that's cascading time impacts that we can save by reviewing grammar. That, like, why spend time on that when I can put more people on processing the raw data and then outputting it into a format that we can use and ingest more efficiently?
That it reminds me when we had Sergeant Major Sampson here on the show, one of the things that he talked about was finding a way to streamline some of those bureaucratic processes and how AI and automation was able to assist with that. And it really sounds like you're echoing that same point, that doing the analysis is one aspect that still has a very heavy human involvement, but finding ways to automate those processes is where we're starting to gain those efficiencies and allowing not only the analyst to focus on the actual analysis, but decreasing the load on everybody else within that administrative chain as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think future of AI in the Army, I think it's two things that I'm noticing. So one is the adoption of agentic AI that's now coming into the commercial space of how do I take maybe not quite as well-defined task, but how do I enable it to address some of my workflows and accomplish tasks for me? I think that's going to become more mature and more integrated as we come along. And we're seeing that now with Next Gen C2 and some more of the cutting edge work. And the other thing is pushing AI as far forward onto the edge as possible. How do we get that down to the platoon leader, which is well and good and helps enable that platoon leader on the objective, increases security, increases efficiency. But one thing that I think we still need to address and spend a bit more time on is power consumption. How do you do compute at the edge? You can enable them long term. But then also, how do I increase that security? Because every time I have to do a call back to a data center to come back from an intel guy, that potentially highlights where that adversary is. So the last thing we want to do is highlight where our forces are while they're using AI. If they can't do it locally or on the edge, that's a good balance I think we have to strike as we look forward.
Yeah, that's been a conversation that we've had a lot recently. And I think that kind of gets to your point, which is, how do we protect those data links both between the forward compute and those forward server stacks? And then how do we protect that information and data flow, not just for detection, but for data poisoning, yep, for direct interception of everything that's going to and from those data centers? And how is that going to impact our bandwidth requirements? Because the amount of data that can go back and forth on a lot of these different AI models, whether it's a computer vision that's transmitting a high quality graphics and imagery, or whether it is an LLM that's spitting back thousands of words, that's a lot of traffic that's being put onto a communication system that wasn't designed for that type of bandwidth load. Where do you see the logical solution? Is it one or the other? Is it balancing? Or is there going to be a role for signaliers and AI ML professionals to manage how, when, where, and who is transmitting data between those different compute nodes?
So I think that's going to be situation dependent. And I think the further down the command structure we go, the more we need to enable them as much as possible to do it on-site as possible. Because once you get below like where you have an established headquarters, that needs to be portable with the individual to increase their security, but also increase their capability. I think it's going to rely heavily on the signal and cyber community to help enable that for the data transport. That's why they exist. But we have to, one, enable them to do that. But then secondly, train them on what's the right way to go about it. What's the trade-offs? And how do you best manage and enable that network? And I think that also brings up an interesting point that we've also seen. So one of the other roles that has been asked of me here was in the standup of the 49 Bravo, the potential 490 Bravo, which has the secondary impact of your operational data teams. You have the intel community is trying to do your intel data teams. And so I think the signal community needs to enable it, but I think those teams are where the sweet spot's going to be of how do I tune the capabilities to my individual commander's needs without having to reach back to a central repository or rely on a commercial vendor to come in and do every single step, and then I just deploy it onto a device. We have to have the ability to adapt and modify things to our use case at the formations where it's happening versus the old spoke model. I need an FSR, an FSE, and a long logistics trail just to do any modifications.
And that's a big transition from how we've done things, which I think, going back to what you discussed earlier, as we've run through this cycle of transitioning between large-scale combat operations and contingency and now returning to large-scale combat operations, that ability to not just use the technology or use the application, but to adapt it, to plan with it, to be deliberate about how we're going to employ it and where it's going to be employed, and giving commanders the levers and knobs that they can pull and turn in order to make it more effective. I'd like to go back earlier. You talked about the potential transition into agentic AI. Tell me a little bit more about where you see agentic AI going, and then in particular, where you see the applications for agentic AI in the military.
Agentic AI, for a high level concept of it, is applying like a large language model or another AI system and using it as a coordinator so that way a person doesn't have to know all the promptings, everything that needs to happen on the back end. they can ask that in natural language. And if you orchestrate it correctly, there's one agent that can interpret what are you actually asking, ask probing questions so we can refine it. And then it breaks that down into smaller parts for sub agents to go back, grab the data, bring it back, synthesize it. You can even do some checks about which ones are making sense because large language models do hallucinate, and then serve that back. So that's the key piece of it. Where I see this coming into use is things like information collection management, doing your logstat updates, things like that are very time intensive, labor intensive. So I think if that's where we're trying to experiment, and that's where I think some good use cases are starting to form, because we have clearly defined metrics about what write generally looks like. We have some basic parameters about what is optimal, degraded, severely degraded based upon some of the data sets that came in. Now the hard part is just gathering it in a timely manner and then synthesizing it so that way it passes some checks. The next part is where we need the humans to actually go through there and validate, is this right? I think that's where you also go back to on the big theme of the human-machine teaming is humans inherently know some of the processes and what right looks like or what the commander needs. So relying on that, we use humans to blaze the path, figure out the process, but then we can find things that are repeatable, and then that's where I think the teaming kind of plays into it and can enable them.
Really, as I think about it, an agentic AI is still very much emerging right now. And as I think about where it's at and my exposure to it, I go back to OpenClaw, because it provides a kind of what you got at, right? It's a natural language interface. It allows me to say things, and then it's able to connect to a variety of different external resources, either to pull data or to push data.
Since you brought up OpenClaw and some of the commercial offerings that people are experimenting with, I've been hit by various friends that are adapting this. I think what a lot of people are embracing, there's a certain amount of risk that you can personally assume on the civilian side and what you're willing to underwrite. I think that's also a trade-off that we do in the military side of it, because everything is risk-based. Everything that you integrate into a network increases your potential risk profile. So how do you harden that? How do you ensure that the process happens the same way every time for the auditability? Because the second and third order effects is, if that's a workload that we require and we've openly handed over to that system, what happens whenever the parameters change or the outputs change and we don't catch it and we don't notice it? That could potentially impact lives, that's delays, that's disruptions.
And I think the other thing that you brought up is it introduces risk. And the very classic U.S. Army approach to risk is that it is the commander's role to assess and assume or not assume risk. And as we move towards agentic processes or increasing levels of automation, one of the things that I expect commanders to start asking more routinely is, where is risk being assumed? And that's becoming, in some cases with things like agentic processes, more difficult to really quantify what the risk is and how it's being assumed and where and when it's being assumed, because it can change over time as those processes become optimized by the system.
So part of this is we have to engineer systems for auditability. That's the only way that you can go back in time and figure out, is everything operating as it's intended to, and then why did certain decisions get made? Because there's always going to be a post hoc analysis on what happens. So I think that's part of it. The other part is helping people think through, what are the second and third order effects, and how do I internally recognize risk, but how do I convey that up to a commander to say, here is all of the things that could go wrong with the plan, but here's how we've tried to mitigate it. And I think being proactive in identifying and then mitigating risk for that commander from the staff side is what we owe those commanders.
I want to key in on something that you mentioned, because it's a thing that I've heard a lot from the AI professionals, and it's the importance of auditability and the ability to go back and audit how decisions were made. The interesting thing is that we don't have that same ability to audit decision processes in the human domain. And as we look at it, as a staff officer, I may make a recommendation or a commander may make a decision. We don't have that same depth of detail as to all of the things they considered, right? Is this auditability going to impact the way that commanders view their decision space?
Just because we can't go back and audit a human's decision doesn't mean it's not the correct way or what we need to move towards. Because at the end of the day, if something were to happen, 15-6 officer has to go back and evaluate and gather facts. So in a way, you are auditing that. If you're working with a system and you have the ability to gather why something happened, you need to do it. Because that's how we identify what conditions led to that decision. Was there a fault in the data? Was there a fault in the model? How do we fix that in the future? Because if there's no way for us to figure out what went wrong or why certain things are happening, or just monitor for model drift, there's no way for us to fix that in the future and refine our processes. And as far as taking the commander's ability away and heuristics, we need to team humans with computers so that way they can enable decision making. But at the end of the day, the commander assumes the risk for the action that he takes. That's why we have warrant officers. That's why we have officers and senior NCOs. Their particular task is to look at the data, look at the information coming in, interpret what is the computer telling me, but balance that off of does that meet the real world situation and make a decision on it. So yes, they need to be audited. Yes, we need to compare it, but I don't think we're ever going to move away from the commanders having to balance that out.
I think that brings up the follow-on question then, which is if we're establishing the audit processes for the systems and we understand that commanders are going to retain their individual agency and they're going to retain command authority, is it going to be important for us to have an increase in how we go back and, I don't want to say audit commanders' decisions, but understand the inputs that they're able to quantify as to how and why they made specific decisions in order to assist and refine those AIs. Is there a way to do that? And is that valuable for the system? Or is it better for the system to focus on the science and the commander to focus on the art? And how do we balance those together?
You bring up a good point between the art and the science of command. So I think the AI needs to focus on the science because it can be defined. And then there's always going to be a commander's gut feeling. We just may have a situation where there's no good output and the commander has to make the decision of we're going left or right because that's the least worst decision. Now, as far as refining the process, looking at some of our doctrine and some of our processes, an AR is going to increase in the importance about why we look at some of the things that we did and understand, like, why'd you make certain decisions?
It seems like the purpose of the AR is going to adapt also, right? What did we not do well that we can do better? What are things that we can incorporate that we think would improve the process? But as we move towards these AI models, it's less important for us to discuss those aspects of it and more important to go back and discuss what aspects were considered when a decision was made, because that's really going to be what's driving those evolutions and improvements in the models.
I think referring back to one of my earlier comments of these tailored teams that can help adjust that decision. So as we look at the operational data teams, your intel data teams, and the composition of them, so that way I have signal officers, I have knowledge managers, I have software factory graduates, I have 49 Bravos and AI2C graduates all in there, so that way I have my domain knowledge, where I have that additional training to help adapt and modify and also recognize some model drift so they can recognize the model drift. But then also looking at when are the conditions not meeting the parameters for that model, if we need to adjust, we need to go back to the drawing board. I think that's where the rubber is going to meet the road on adapting AI to a commander's needs. But we're also super early in the formation of these teams. And I think in the next like 4 to 5 years, doing those post-event ARs to identify what data did you need to make that decision and what were you missing is going to be huge as we refine what is that process look like? What do these formations need? And then how do we adjust our training, the whole .mil PF, to build out these formations for what we need them to be in 2030, 2035, 2040?
That brings up something interesting to me as you talk about these roles of these different domain specialists and experts. A lot of what we talk about is what they're doing right now. But when I think about staff operations in operational units, things split between what we're doing right now, which is managing our current operations, and the planning aspect, which is what officers and warrant officers are increasingly focused on as they put out the immediate fires, but they plan for what's going to be happening. Do you see a role for these domain specialists to be involved in deliberate planning processes, especially as we look towards what planning for large-scale combat operations might look like? And if so, what type of planning operations should commanders and chiefs of staff expect from those domain experts?
So looking at the more immediate need of addressing current commanders' priorities, keeping units operational and mission ready. So I think that's part of the thing that we have to address very deliberately, because we don't have the luxury of being able to pull back from the line, tell everyone to take a knee, plan for what's going to be like for 5 years, and pull someone off the line. The op tempo really doesn't allow for that. So I think commanders and chiefs of staff, from the support of AI, that needs to be a cross-cutting planning effort, because the S6 has a requirement to move data and make it available. The S2 has the requirement to help secure it, and ops has the requirement to help enable it and employ the outputs of it. So I think it has to be a whole of staff kind of approach to how we identify it, and then you have a small team that enables it. And the way we've at least approached it thus far is we bring someone that has experience in, say, logistics or intel or infantry, whatever. We send them to specialized training, and then we send them back to the force. So that way they have that core knowledge about, okay, what does my general staff process need, or what does the Army actually need? The long-term plan on this is we need that feedback of balancing out, here's what our actual demands are in the now, because that's going to inform where do we need to be in 10 years. But then also, are we planning far enough ahead? The technology is adapting and modernizing so fast, that's things that we say we may need in 10 years, we may be able to get there in 3. So we need to compress the development time. And so I think knowing where the demands are, where we need to put better priority, more emphasis, more resources is ultimately what's going to drive where do we make gains in 10 years, because you can't get there unless you solve and set conditions now for that.
That makes artificial intelligence a unique problem set, because as opposed to other technologies where the significant technological leaps have been accomplished either by the military or in parallel with the military, AI is advancing in parallel in both the civilian sector and the military sector. So we're not significantly in front of the civilian sector in many ways. And so the expectation that leaders are forming is going to be this unique hybrid understanding of what they are seeing in their military experience combined with what they're reading, seeing, and experiencing in the civilian sector. And it's creating a unique fusion of expectations for leaders who are doing things of building out our POM cycles and identifying what the future looks like.
I see three kind of circles all working together. You have the academia side, which is also doing AI research and trying to build out what comes after agentic AI. Military, we have our operational need, and we have, just being the nature of the government, we have the resources to be able to help scale and employ that. But we lag behind the commercial sector and some of the frontier models, although the Department of War is moving towards that. The commercial sector, the reason why they move so fast is because there's the economic incentive to do it. But also there's significant capital investment into that from government, the large VC firms, to ramp up that capability and commoditize it. We need to be able to leverage some of that insight and get the latest and greatest model, contribute to their efforts as well. But again, it goes back to the whole risk profile and other things that come into that, where we have to be choosy on which model that we use. We have to do the evaluations of what's the trade-off and the accuracy for what we use it for, and that's where we have to be a little more discerning.
Anytime that we adopt a new technology like that, it brings into question, how are we going to not only field it, but how are we going to train not just the domain experts in how to use it? We've got a process that we're building out for that. But as it becomes widely fielded in the military, how do we train the users in how to employ it effectively? What role do you see, and what do you see a training pipeline look like for users? I'm interested in your thoughts as to what it looks like, not for the domain experts, but for those commanders and primary staff who are going to need to rely on the outputs of those systems to help inform their decisions.
So I think time may be actually on our side for this one, really looking at our younger generations as they come in. Some of the older individuals like myself, hey, we have to learn it and understand it. But some of the younger generations come in, they are going to grow up with AI. Same as like I grew up with computers, and I replaced some of my mentors that grew up with typewriters. So I think we'll eventually get there where we don't have to put quite as much emphasis on learning like what is structured versus unstructured data. That may be a bit of hope on that. We have the foundation knowledge as you come in, but you need to have some people that have some deeper domain experts. So that way I know how to log in to email. I know how to do certain tasks, but I don't know the full intricacies of the DOTIN and everything else. That's why I have a signal warrant that makes the ones and zeros process or transmit through the system as I need it. I think that's where we're going to have that tiered approach of we have to educate the commanders on how to use it, where to ask the right questions, have the right type of skepticism and the capabilities. But we also need to get those that know how to bend the system to what the task is and better employ the capabilities or tune it to the institutional or the operational needs. I think that's what we have to grapple with in the Army is if you want someone that knows how to do this and is good at it, you have to invest the time, you have to invest the resources to put this in and not have this as a secondary duty. We have to find that balance.
Sounds like if we want to fully adopt AI, we're going to have to put the resources after that effort. Chief, thank you so much for being here today. A ton of great insights. Before we close up, I'll give you a chance for anything you want to highlight for anybody who might be listening today.
Yeah, my one parting shot would be just highlighting the fact that we're doing a lot of great things in the Army, experimenting, getting the capability down to the users as much as possible to adopt the technology and innovate at their pain point. I think one thing that we need to start thinking about is how do I scale what a unit may be doing really well? How do I scale that to a larger enterprise to enable more units? But then secondly, how do we sustain that long term? Innovation is great, but unless you plan for the sustainment and the long-term enabling, the way the military goes for movement cycles and manning and resources, that may die on the vine 6 months after that person leaves, unless someone maintains it. So I think that's what we have to start to think about. How do we embrace innovation at the edge to make everyone's life better?
Thank you very much. Again, it's been great having you on the show today.